Mr. Morris.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. The finding by the district court that John May was his cousin's supervisor clearly rested upon an erroneous finding of fact that his cousin, whose name is Collier, was hands-on, quote, hands-on, close quote, with the drugs, and that he, quote, delivered, close quote, the drugs. That is not supported in the record in any respect. This is an unusual plea agreement because it was specifically negotiated over the facts, and in each instance, these three transactions, in each one, the very same language appears in the plea agreement that I'll read the first one at the top of page 4. May left the house to pick up the crack, returned a few minutes later with the drugs. Collier accepted $4,000 from the CS as payment for the drugs and was present when the CS received approximately 186 grams of crack, which May supplied. Now, the government's brief doesn't honor its agreement as to those facts. It recites repeatedly that Collier was directed by May to deliver the drugs, and it says that Collier was a mule. Now, that's just simply not correct. The district judge adopted this argument, this fact, and said that Mr. Collier is the one who is hands-on with the drugs. This is a sentencing transcript at page 22. Mr. Collier is the one who is hands-on with the drugs in front of the cooperating source. In fact, they were all in that grandmother's house at the same time when the drugs were delivered by May and when the money was received. Without that finding of fact, it's questionable whether the district judge would have found that May was a supervisor and enhanced his sentence by, I believe it was 2 levels.
So what do you say Collier's role was in the transactions?
The Weaver case talks about this, that there was sometimes two defendants are simply collaborating. And so the role was that they were like partners. They were family members. They'd grown up together. They did this deal together. The only thing that Collier did independently was to deliver a sample. And that didn't really...
Did that at the direction of May?
I believe so. Although it's not exactly... Yeah, I think that's correct. I think that's a fact.
And... Did Collier tell the CS what the prices would be?
Yes, that was part of his task, yes.
And he was instructed as to prices by May?
I don't know if that's for sure, but I do think it's part of the record that he told him the price.
Was Collier deciding the price? Is that your contention?
I don't think so, no. I think Mr. May acknowledges that this was mainly his transaction.
Collier accepted the money, right?
He counted the money at the house. This has been the language that's used by the district judge and by the government in its brief in this court is that he picked up the money. And the way they argue it is that he delivered the drugs as if he went off independently and then picked up the money and brought it back. But that's not what happened. He was just asked to count the money, which is the most minor task.
Then it was divided and May got most of it, right?
I think that they divided it in proportion to what they did.
May got most of it.
He did, in fact, get much more of the
money. What do we make of the indication that Mr. May said, quote, I'm trying not to get involved?
I don't know. Both of them were in special education together. Nobody wants to, get into trouble. I didn't find that phrase particularly important. I looked at what was actually done and what is stipulated to have been done. And there's not even any in the safety valve proffer, which the government stipulated, was sufficient to meet the requirements of the safety valve. That is, that it was truthful and complete. There's not much talk of that May was directing Collier. It's that certain things were done by each of them. And that's why I argued all through this case that they were really collaborating together, and that to try to put this into some sort of criminal organization, some sort of mini enterprise, is a distortion of the facts. And the government's repeated efforts to change the facts and to enhance them suggest that they maybe think there's some problem with it too. The Mankiewicz case, where the son has his father assisting in a drug deal, the father unloads the bales of marijuana, and then he takes someone to meet with a leader, and this court said that was not enough to make the son the supervisor of his father, I think is a very persuasive analogy. Because here, Collier only goes to take the sample, and the government argues that puts him at risk, but it doesn't. Nobody gets arrested bringing the sample. They get arrested at the drug deal. And in fact, what actually happened to these...
I don't understand that comment. They've got him if they want him, right?
Pardon?
They've got him if they want him.
Well, they do, but it's a lower risk.
He's already at risk. He can be turned, etc., right?
That's true. That's true, but it's not nearly the same.
He's taken cocaine and delivered it.
Correct. We're not clear where that cocaine came from. There's nothing in the record as to whether it was his or Mr. May's. The risk to him is minor in reality compared to Mr. May, who transported a half a kilogram of cocaine back and forth in his car and delivered it to the buyer. So in terms of risk, May took much greater risk, and that's part of the rationale for why he would take a greater share of the profits. Many of the other factors that are considered under the guideline, recruitment, coercion, discipline, are not present here. There's no indication that there's that May is sort of managing Collier. Much of it appears to be that they simply did this together. The sharing of the proceeds, which we were just talking about in this court's decision in Rosales, the allocation of funds was criticized. I see my light's on. I would like to reserve some time on the second question, so maybe I will, if I may, I'll save that for rebuttal.
If it's a brand new issue, why don't you talk about it so that the other side has an opportunity to respond? It's just a suggestion. Mm-hmm.
The basic rule is, if you don't make an argument on a point, you can hardly rebut it later.
Well, I will. The 3553F4 specifically and plainly provides that safety valve, a condition of obtaining the safety valve is that you not be a supervisor, quote, of others in the offense.
Right. And what do you have to say about the Dictionary Act? Dictionary Act, 1 U.S.C. 1, says that the use of the plural includes the use of the singular. Also says the use of the singular includes the use of the plural. In other words, judges are supposed to ignore whether any word in the U.S. Code is singular or plural. That's what the Dictionary Act says. Clear as day.
Well,
what does that do to your argument?
It's a bit of a blow because I wasn't aware of the Dictionary Act, but
I thought every lawyer on his first day of law school would go and look up 1 U.S.C. 1.
It's the very first sentence.
Yes.
I'm devastated that I didn't do that, but I think that the incredibly important principle of law is that criminal statutes ought to be read for their plain meaning.
It does say unless the context indicates otherwise. Is there anything about the context here that you think indicates otherwise?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think there's a variety of things in the context. When you read the provision, it's first of all it lists organizer, leader, manager, or supervisor, suggesting an organization, a multi-person organization. The guideline itself talks about five or more people. There's another section that talks about whether there's at least three, so the question of numbers is clearly an issue in this case. The final phrase in 3553F is, and was not engaged in a continuing criminal enterprise. Again, an indication of a major organization. And so It seems clear to me that the plain meaning of this under the rule of lenity is that it has to be more than one supervisee. Otherwise, it just simply isn't covered.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Ms. Greenwald.
Your Honors, beginning with the 3B1.1 argument, the district court found, and the evidence showed, that Defendant May negotiated the transactions. This is on the judge's opinion, pages 21 through 23. May negotiated the transactions. He's the one who asked and recruited Collier to participate. He's the one who, using the language of Figueroa, told Collier what to do and decided if Collier did it. He directed Collier to deliver the sample. He admitted that in the plea agreement. In the plea agreement, page 3, quote, a short time later, May told Collier to meet the CS and give the CS a small quantity of crack cocaine as a sample and to tell the CS the price for larger quantities, which was $1,400 for one 63-gram package. He admitted that in the plea agreement in writing and affirmed to it orally at the taking of the guilty plea. And I think that is a particularly pivotal act because at that time when he sends Collier to do this, it does explain what he means by I don't want to be involved, because at that time he's kind of checking out this buyer. Is he going to be, you know, is he a cooperator with the government? Is he a law enforcement agent? He sends Collier to do that. Thereafter, whether we use the word deliver, Collier, and we have this in the this is in the government's version as well as in the PSR, Collier in his plea agreement or his statements to the government does say he delivered it. Mr. May, however, defense counsel is absolutely correct. Mr. May always took the position that he was present kind of in the background from his own statements in his proffer for the safety valve. That he left it on the stair, that he left it on a table, but Mr. Collier's the one in the forefront because he's the one who's going to accept the money from the buyer. And those are all at Mr. May's direction. And pointed out by the district court, Defendant May decided how much Collier would be paid, and he did claim the bulk of profits for himself. And the evidence does show also in Mr. May's safety valve proffer that how much he paid Collier kind of depended on how much they were selling, and Collier did get a fewer amount. So under all of those things admitted to by Mr. May, and whether we call him a mule because he accepted the money and was there for president of the drugs, or whether we call him as a liver, or whether we call him whatever, all those things he did, and he did at Mr. May's direction.
Ms. Greenwald, would you agree that this is a case where the judge could have come out either way?
Arguably, yes. I'm not going to, you know, overstate. I think that he is on very solid ground. I don't mean to suggest that this is a weak case in any way, but there certainly was argument, and that's acknowledged by the government in that we agreed to disagree over this factor. And we don't agree to disagree when we think our case is absolutely overwhelming and open to no other interpretation. But I have to say, reviewing the record and arguing it through, I think we were on very strong ground, and certainly under the standard of review of clear error, this court reverses only if it is left with a definite and firm conviction a mistake was made, and if there are two permissible views of the evidence, the fact finder's choice is not clearly erroneous. So even within that area, even if we don't say this is a slam dunk, we agreed to disagree. We certainly believe the evidence is ample and that the judge this court should not be left with a clear and distinct feeling that a mistake was made. And also to that point, if you go to just relative culpability, which is what's behind the whole 3B1.1 factor, clearly Defendant May was more culpable, so it fits under that too. And as far as the Minkowitz case, I mean, that case, the court points out in that case that it was a one-off instance of using the father. It wasn't ongoing like we have here. The context here was that there was a higher leader up who was organizing this whole drug. It was a reverse buy. They were buying, the defendants were buying the...
Why do people say reverse buy?
Okay.
The word in English, I believe, is sell.
Okay, thank you. In any event, they There was another leader.
Otherwise, every time I go to Macy's, Macy's is reverse buying things.
There was a higher leader who was kind of calling the shots, and the defendant at issue with his father were kind of just players in the whole thing. And finally, and most importantly, this court points out that, quote, the relationship with the defendant and his father in connection with this offense was not the sort of real and direct influence aimed at furthering the criminal activity. Here, you know, because it was just kind of an aside, dad, go put that over there, dad, go, you know, take him here. This is an ongoing direct influence on conducting these narcotics transactions where defendant May is.
There were three transactions?
There were three plus the sample.
Plus the sample, okay.
And the quantity of crack cocaine we're talking about here is 580 grams, almost double what's required to get to the mandatory minimum of 10 years that Mr. May faced. And I would also point out here that the government, in its plea negotiations with the defendant, did agree, I mean, this is in our plea agreement, did agree that we would not seek, he could have been facing a 20-year mandatory minimum had we kept the notice of his prior conviction on the record. Moving to the statutory interpretation issue, you saved me a lot of writing, Judge Easterbrook, by pointing out.
You could have saved yourself a lot of writing by referring to the Dictionary Act in your brief.
Because I was not familiar with USC Section 1, so I have learned a lot today, and we'll go back and read that, because clearly under that.
There's a lot of other stuff in the Dictionary Act, too.
The rest of our brief certainly still goes to serve that within the context of this act, it does make sense for it to mean that way, and I now know that Congress wasn't out of its mind when it wrote this statute, which is part of what I was thinking when I was writing this brief. It now explains that Congress clearly is aware of Section 1 of USC, and I am now too. So with apologies to the court for that, obviously that just, I think, makes our argument overwhelming, because it does show that in context that's clearly the meaning. So unless the court has any other questions, we'll rest on our brief and ask you to please affirm the sentence imposed by the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Morris?
May I have one sentence or two?
You've got several, maybe even 30 seconds worth.
If the defendant had presented facts contrary to those that were agreed in the brief, the government would have been very unhappy with him. That is exactly what the government has done here. Their footnote 3 on page 3 of the brief says that Collier, in his plea agreement, says that he delivered the drugs. That is not part of the record, at least in the sentencing proceeding. It was never mentioned, and I believe it's false, and I think the government has stipulated that it's false, because it acknowledged that Mr. May's safety valve proffer was truthful and complete. And Mr. May's proffer says he delivered the drugs. And that's very important, because it leaves Collier standing in his own grandmother's house counting some money and handing it. That's all he did. He didn't do anything else. That's not a sufficient activity. It's just like the father in Mankiewicz. And the only thing that's left is the delivery of the sample. And I don't think that alone, that's a one-off thing. And the government, after all, just repeated
it.
Thank you. I could go on. Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. And Mr. Morris, we appreciate your